And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books. It is our 20th show. And as always, yes.
Yeah. They said we'd
never make it. As always, we are excited to come to you from Chatter, a for-profit business, which is on the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer Street. I shouldn't say a for-profit business, a for-profit restaurant.
That's right.
The only place, well, by the time you hear this, the game might be over tonight, but any game you want to see, there's 11 TVs, the place to watch the Masters Thursday through Sunday, Nats games all season long.
Right.
Absolutely.
By chance, you listen to this.
I don't know, it's a late tip tonight. You might get here in time.
Yeah, I'll be posting this around 8, so if you hear it,
get over here.
Yeah. Are we all rooting for UVA?
Of course.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
What?
No.
What?
No.
Yeah, they're a local team.
Why are you not rooting for UVA?
And we like Tony Bennett.
Blue blazer wearing.
not the basketball team.
Wow. I'm rooting for Texas Tech because nobody expected them to get here.
Okay.
Nobody expected any of them to get here. As we were saying before the show, Chuck Culpepper of the Washington Post, who we will have on in a few weeks, who wrote a very funny book about soccer, called it the Rescue Dog Final Four because nobody expected them to survive, and everybody loves them, and it's true.
I don't love
them. Come here, you.
Right.
Come here, Virginia.
So with us tonight, David Aldridge, Jeannie McManus, Michael Kornheiser, Mark Stern, Tori Clark. It is great to be here, and a little bit later, we are going to have Alan Topol as our featured author, and a lot of people in the D.C. area know him, and if you've been through any airports, you've seen his books. He is a hotshot lawyer by day. He is the writer of 14 geopolitical thrillers, he calls them. The Washington Post one time said he's given these guys like Grisham and others a run for their money. Really fascinating stuff. He throws in CW, Calvert Woodley references, which we like, of course.
A cheeserie.
So we're going to have him. What's on tap tonight, though? We've got a couple of things. David walked in with a heavy load of books. I guess we have a book report assignment tonight.
Yes.
We have a poetry slam. And then at the end, instead of Deserted Island, something we talked about last week, I believe, we're going to have Castaway Island. When is it okay to say no to a book, to just quit the book? Mm-hmm. In my words, or can we Marie Kondo it? We do not have two things. We do not have a Calvert Woodley wine and cheese this evening, because dear Michael, was at the French Embassy all afternoon on important business.
Intrigue.
Businessman.
Intrigue. But Manager Ron gave us from our favorite Fess Parker Vineyard.
It
was Admiral Stavridis, right?
Yes.
Who had been to the Fess Parker Vineyard. So we have a lovely Marcellus 2016 white wine, a blend, Ron told me. And they have a little language here on the back of the Fess Parker bottle. Time spent on the water for the Parker family was an important part of growing up in Santa Barbara. Fess and his wife, Marcella, I guess the wine is named after Marcella, often packed up the kids, Eli and Ashley, for weekend excursions to the Channel Islands or beyond. This wine celebrates this part of the family's history. This white blend showcases bright, fresh acidity, backing generous peach. Who writes these things? Right?
Same people that write greeting cards.
Yeah. And name the colors on Mercedes. You ever see the names on Mercedes? Because then you can charge extra.
Sounds like the perfect wine for the weather we've had the last 2 days.
Yes.
I think you're right. And I think it's enticing spice and mineral notes add complexity. But you can get this here at Chatter.
Now I have the theme to Davy Crockett running through my head.
Davy Crockett.
Earworm. Earworm.
Wild frontier.
Okay, David, should we go to you first?
Absolutely,
right.
Tori.
And by the way, there was a little exchange on Facebook. We put out, by popular demand, we posted your book report on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And there was a little exchange going. Somebody went to a high school production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest over the weekend, and they said, thank you, David, I could understand it because I read your book report.
There you go. So I'm here to serve.
Just give and give and give.
Until it hurts, and then I give some more. <'cause you know. laughs> All right. I have books.
Okay.
So since Mark, whoever.
There's more than one book you're giving out?
No.
Providing
I'm giving
a choice.
Her a choice.
Yes.
Mark gave me a choice of books, as you recall. So I'm giving Tori, out of fairness.
It's a lovely bag.
It's a nice
bag.
Yeah,
we thought you had come from a baby shower.
No,
when you
I got this
in.
At DeMatha yesterday. They gave me a hat. It was very nice. I have three books, and you can review any one of the three. Number one, there's two nonfiction and one fiction.
Okay.
All right. Number one.
She looks like she's about to get a flu shot.
No, these just are good brings back.
These are good books.
Like Sister Mally and Mary Aloysius in fifth grade.
No, these are good books that I've read.
Clark.
All right. First one, a classic journalism book. The Boys on the Bus by Timothy Cross.
Oh, like that. Yeah. Like that a lot.
About the 72 election.
So, far that one's winning.
And my professor, Richard Stout, who was at American University, was one of the boys on the bus and is featured in that book.
Okay.
And he was a wonderful man.
Would you like me better if I, and like my report better if I did that?
It's up to you. Second, a classic of literature, Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison.
Oh, yeah.
Another
good one.
That's
David,
one. Another
excellent.
One.
Okay.
The third one, a relatively new book, but a very popular book, a bestseller, Unbroken.
Oh,
by
yeah.
Laurie Hildebrand.
Sure.
About the soldier in World War II.
That is a tough read.
Wow. I thought that was about the Redskins' defense in 91. Then don't break.
That's right. Man and Manly is chapter five.
I mean, I don't mean to put the book down. It's beautifully written, but there are some scenes in there that are
tough.
Rough going.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
I feel like I need to consult with Michael because,
as
I said, I'm going to Photoshop my head onto Michael's body so he can do this for me, a la Mr. Singer in USC. Wow, David, those are excellent choices.
Yes.
And you like all three of these books?
I like all three of them. Read them all.
Okay. I'm going to think about it
before I commit. Take your time.
Thank you.
Have you finished yet? Are you done with your report? Can we get that from you now?
Oh, payback is tough.
Again. Just, give me a deadline. I can meet it. I can meet it.
I might cram
the night before.
You all gave me ample time to do this.
Yeah. The time that you need. Ample time.
Okay. Yeah. And part of the joy for me listening to your book report is what we are learning along the way.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Untimed testing.
Excellent choices, though.
Yes.
Thank you, David.
Outstanding, David.
Okay.
Thank you. That's awesome.
All right. Now we're going to go to the Poetry Slam.
Thank you,
Michael Kornheiser, who pointed out to me that it is National Poetry Month.
There you go.
Who knew? But if you do go and, of course, Google National Poetry Month, there's this great list of things you can do in National Poetry Month, including the kind of things we're doing, going to open mic sessions, who would ever do this. One of my favorites is recreate a poet's favorite food or drink by following his or her recipe. And then there's, of course, there's a link to poets' favorite recipes. Mm. One is call your post office. We were talking about post offices and stamps earlier. Ask them to do stamps on your favorite poet. Read poems. Watch a poetry movie. Who knew that even existed?
I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah. And then there are all these really, really obscure poets I've never heard of, but that I have to say up front, I feel about poetry the way Tony Kornheiser feels about jazz.
It just seems
pretentious. It often seems overwrought. I realized, everyone's looking at me with sad looks.
No. I get what you're saying.
Right?
There is a fun activity that I recommend some of you try if you're listening. So say you're reading and this works for fiction.
Yes.
I would recommend you try and find a character you want to explore more fully or a location you want to explore more fully. So the setting, that location, can become a character unto itself. And I would have you choose, say, one page, 1.5 pages. And the activity is called writing by erasure. So you would try and say, I'm going to take this entire page and I'm going to cross out all the extraneous information that's not going to be revealing more about this character, location, setting in that moment. I want to see development. I want to see who they are. And try and define it, say, 20 words. And you cannot change the order of the words, but you are allowed to add punctuation and you can add, say, style changes. So if you do want to put something in italics, go ahead. If you want to add capital letters, go ahead. But what you'll find is as you trim this down, something emerges that looks like a poem. And it's a really friendly way into poetry because it takes away that stress barrier of, is this right? Is this correct? Does it sound the way it should sound?
Mm-hmm. I'd invite Michael to my next dinner party.
Exactly.
And that could be the entertainment.
And you could pass out 1.5 page things and let everybody.
Okay, I'm going to go first. I'm going to just, executive privilege. I'm going to go first because mine are so bad. And I sat down and I thought, okay, what poems do I remember? And I know of famous poems, but I didn't really remember them. I'd be lying. And if you woke me up at 3 o'clock in the morning from a dead sleep, and said recite a poem, I would recite ones that I learned when I was a small child. I have no idea why. Little Willie poems. Do any of you know Little Willie poems?
No.
They're famous and infamous. Came around somewhere in the 1800s. I really couldn't figure out where they came from. But it was lovely things like I'll do two readings. Little Willie, feeling bright, bought a stick of dynamite. Curiosity seldom pays. It rained Willie for 7 days. One more morbid than the next.
That's a life lesson.
Wait. In the family drinking well, Willie pushed his sister Nell. Said his mother, drawing water, "It's mighty tough to raise a daughter." There are 5 or 6 like that. I can do them all. I remember them like it was yesterday. And again, I don't remember why I learned these or how I learned these, but those are my poems. But desperately trying to save myself, I looked up one of our favorite people, George Washington. Mm-hmm. And the Library of Congress has what they claim are 2 poems written by him that are known to survive. Evidently, he wrote some poetry, but these are the 2 that they have that they claim the only 2 that have survived. And both are when he's a teenage boy, frustrated in love, evidently. There was a young woman with whom he was fascinated, Frances Alexander, and I'll just do a few lines. "From your bright, sparkling eyes, I was undone. Rays you have, more transparent than the sun. Amidst its glory in the rising day, none can you equal in your bright array. Constant in your calm and unspotted mind, equal to all, but will to none prove kind." And it goes on, and it's lovely.
That's lovely.
Yeah, it's a nice little side of George that we didn't know.
There you go.
Okay. From Little Willie to George, who would like to go next? Who's going to be the saddest?
I'm going to be the saddest.
Okay, Jeannie goes last.
Okay.
Oh, really want to bring it home with tears?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I'm going to be the saddest.
All right, I'll dive in here.
Okay.
Well, as you guys know, I love poetry.
Yes.
I love poetry.
Up there with you for military history.
It is. Yeah. Because what I loved about it was the economy of words and the imagery that you would...
As Michael was saying.
Yeah. Instead of, you know, a million words, you got to do it in very confined fashion. And the imagery that you can evoke, if you do it well, is brilliant. And it's timeless. Yeah. You know, guys like Yeats and Eliot and Wordsworth, Coleridge. We always joke around quoting Coleridge, you know, and Xanadu did Kubla Khan.
Right.
I mean, the language, the imagery of it, and the music of those words, it just stays with you if it's done well. What I have an issue with, Tori, and I think you might agree with me on this, is the modern sort of like tortured, you know, the person in the back of the English class that was like, "I've got something to read." And you're like, "Oh, God."
Yeah.
The pretension of that.
Save us.
Yeah, exactly. Just, yeah.
And my hand goes back down.
No. So I had like target overload with all the different things that I wanted to bring into this. I'm just going to, I have a couple brief things I want to read. This one's for you, DA.
Okay.
"Dark and lonely on the summer night, kill my landlord. Kill my landlord. Watchdog barking, do we bite? Kill my landlord. Kill my landlord." That's just for DA. That, of course, is Eddie Murphy from Saturday Night. My favorite poem, because I didn't understand it as well when I was a kid, but I love the language of it, is by T.S. Eliot. Now, I could sit and read The Wasteland a million times and still not truly understand all the references and everything that he was getting at, but The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, to me, is just it might be my favorite thing he's ever.
I like the reactions on Michael's face during this conversation.
Huh? My face. Yes,
I'm nodding.
No, okay. he's a pro.
I thought he was shaking his head, being like, "No, this is terrible."
He approves.
I'm just going to read the first bit here. "Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky, like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels, and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells, streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent, to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit." And in the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. I just love that.
I like that.
Great. Yeah, it's nice. Yeah, and it goes on and on and on and on.
It's lovely.
But I want to leave you with this. I'm sorry. I'm like totally like.
This is good.
This is good.
And this actually is my favorite poem. And it doesn't really mean a lot. There's no deeper meaning to it. It was written by Breaker Morant. I think I probably mentioned this guy before. Mm-hmm. The English soldier who was
executed. We all saw the movie.
Yes, Breaker. Yeah. This is the poem. Yeah, actually, I can do it without even looking. This is the poem he wrote on February 27th, 1902, the night before he was executed. "In prison cell I sadly sit, a damned crestfallen chappie. I own to you I feel a little bit unhappy. And though 'tis neither the place nor time to reel off rhyming diction, yet we'll pen a final rhyme while waiting crucifixion. And no matter what end they decide, quick lime or boiling oil, sir, we'll do our best when crucified to finish off in style, sir. But we bequeath the parting tip as sound advice for such men who come across in transport ship to polish off the Dutchmen. If you encounter any boars, you really must not loot 'em. And if you wish to leave these shores, for pity's sake, don't shoot them. So let's toss a bumper down our throat before we pass to heaven and toast the trim set petticoat we leave behind in Devon.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. How old were you when you learned that?
Probably like 13.
Yeah, I was learning the Little Willie poems. Yeah.
I posted it on the bulletin board at St. George's every year on the anniversary of his death, much to the amusement of everybody in the school. Said, look at this weird guy. What's he doing? So, anyway, that just nicely done.
Yes.
Very nicely done.
Very good.
Okay.
All
David?
Right. I guess I'll go next. I don't have anything that cool. Although your poems, your Little Willie poems, reminded me, my mother taught me this poem. She taught all of us this poem when we were kids. The bee is such a busy soul. He has no time for birth control. And that is why in times like these, there are so many sons of bees.
I love your mother.
Oh, yes. That's great.
That is phenomenal.
I always think of my mother when I think of that. Oh, anyway.
It's fabulous.
I picked Langston Hughes. I just love Langston Hughes.
Sure.
I too
sing America.
Let America be America again. Yes, that's the one. There's so many that you could pick. But I am so drawn to this because it's funny. I was reading on this, and someone was comparing him to Whitman poetry and how they felt like Whitman was optimistic and Langston Hughes was pessimistic in this poem. And I thought it was the exact opposite. I think the whole title, Let America Be America Again, speaks to the assumption, or at least the thought, that there was one time when America was America, and we need to try and get back to that. And so I think he's...
Does it surprise you that he was hopeful or believed that it once...
I don't know. I mean, when he came of age in the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s, I mean, there was an explosion of creation in Harlem in that decade. And I think it's hard to imagine that they were pessimistic because it was their creation.
Right.
There was no one helping them. There was no one helping Duke Ellington. There was no one helping Langston Hughes. They were doing it on their own. And it was kind of their vision of America, their vision of themselves. And so while some of it was pessimistic, I don't think all of it was, and I don't think this is a pessimistic poem. It's a long poem, so I'm not going to read all of it, but I'm going to read some of it. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet, and yet must be, the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me an ugly name you choose, the steel of freedom does not stain. From those who live like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again. America, oh yes, I say it plain, America never was America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be. I just think that's amazingly optimistic.
That is great. That is fantastic.
It's incredibly optimistic.
I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, yes. I mean, so I just think he's an incredible...
When did he write it? I'm sorry.
This is in the early 20s.
Wow,
late 20s.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
Nicely done.
That
okay.
Brilliant.
Michael?
So I had two choices, and I wasn't sure... which choice I would make until I was sitting here. The first was Elizabeth Bishop's One Art, but my wife told me this afternoon that every high school freshman has read that poem, so I will not bring you back to my discussion
on mastery
versus disaster. So I'm actually going to go Nigel. Mark has made me think about the value of structure, particularly for people who are against poetry and are looking for a way back in. And I'm going to go back to some Shakespearean sonnets. And part of the value of this is the known structure. When you have a certain amount of lines to work with and you have known changes and rhythms within the quatrains leading up to that final couplet, will there be a question that's finally addressed in that couplet? Will it answer a mathematical solution? If that's how you like looking at literature and poetry, you can really sift through these lines and look for that volta after those opening quatrains to see if you're going to get some resolution. So I went back to Sonnet 115, and this was a sonnet that we had read at our wedding. Those lines that I before have writ do lie, even those that said I cannot love you dear, yet then my judgment knew no reason why. My most full flame should afterwards burn clear, dearer, clearer. But reckoning time, whose millioned accidents creep in twixt vows and change decrees of kings, tan sacred beauty, blunt the sharpest intents, divert strong minds to the course of altering things. Alas, why, fearing of time's tyranny, might I not then say, now I love you best, when I was certain or uncertainty crowning the present, doubting of the rest. Love is a babe. Then might I not say so, to give full growth to that which still doth grow? When we first encounter these lines, I don't care who you are, it sounds beautiful, but it kind of sounds just like something that's washing through your head as you're trying to figure this out. Mm-hmm. But that's why when you try and go into the quatrains and find where the meaning is, it's really helpful. I love the idea of coming back to something that you have written is a lie. It's not a lie out of malice, it's just a lie. Words are static on the page. It doesn't encompass the ups and downs, the growth that is love. What I love about the ending here is love is a babe, to give full growth to that which doth still does grow. I don't know how my love is going to change over the years. I don't know what texture it's gonna grow. It's not gonna just be something that is vertical.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the flip side of this, I want to take something that's not so...
Okay, but wait. Why did you choose it for your wedding?
Honestly?
Yeah.
Because I think I look forward to encountering how that texture is going to change every single day, every single year.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I love how additions to the family. I look back at the last year and a half and how our son Walker has added just another little bump to what that love is, and say that moment in 2014, August 2nd, when we were married, that was not the end-all, be-all
right.
of our relationship, and love is allowed to change. I also wanted to bring it back to Sonnet 61. So the first one I read is all about love. This one sounds like a high school text exchange between your first love. Is it thy will thy image should keep open my heavy eyelids to the weary night? Dost thou desire my slumbers should be broken while shadows like to thee do mock my sight? Is it thy spirit that thou sendest from thee so far from home into my deeds to pry, to find out shames and idle hours in me, the scope and tenor of thy jealousy? Oh, not thy love, though much as is not so great. It is my love that keeps mine eye awake, mine own true love that doth my rest defeat, to play the watchman ever for thy sake. For thee watch I whilst thou dost wake elsewhere, from me far off, with others all too near. Again, this sounds like it could be taken
completely from
someone's text exchange
yeah.
with a boyfriend,
which
girlfriend.
Which is a pretty interesting way you think about it, do Shakespeare, mm-hmm. a la text. Or
yeah.
they don't even text anymore. It's Instagram, it's Snapchat,
right.
everything else. That's a fascinating idea.
But if you break down these first two quatrains, it's all you.
Yeah.
And then right at the end, it comes back to me. It's all my doing. My love is what's keeping me up at night, because I'm the righteous one here, while you're off in someone else's bed.
Nice.
Wow.
Wow, I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot. All right, you ready, Jeannie?
Let me begin on a light note, because, Tori, your poems reminded me of something.
See, you all have them. Thank you.
Yeah.
You all have them in your...
Well, this was my sophomore year in high school. I first of all, let me say that I like poetry. I studied poetry in college and in high school as well.
Busy girls had to have learned poetry.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But sophomore year in high school at Busy, we were... in a class that experimented with different forms of poetry, and the limerick was one.
Thank you.
And we were asked each to write a limerick. You know, you learn a lot about meter and rhyme and stuff
Did
like that.
Did they have certain words you weren't allowed to use, like Nantucket?
Yeah, Nantucket.
I think they assumed we would not use those words. But this is what I wrote, and I remember it to this day. There once was a girl, Antoinette, who was nipped by a fierce castanet. Her finger dropped off and fell in the broth, and her poor little finger was et.
See? Thank you.
By the future food editor of the Washington Post.
Yeah. I think that the nun was somewhat horrified by this.
All making me feel
that
better about my little
okay.
cakes.
Uh-huh.
Outstanding.
So now, on a serious note.
Now to bring the whole house down.
Yeah. I collect poetry. I read a lot of it in The New Yorker, and I have for decades. And then I buy relevant books. And for a while, I was getting a poem a day on some sort of online thing, and finally I stopped because it was too much. But one poet that I particularly like is Howard Nemirov. And this particular poem reminds me, well, first of all, in preparation for today, I went through the poems I've collected, lots of clips. They were about one of three things. They were about love, death, or love and death. Mm-hmm. So that sort of shows you what, like, an upbeat kind of gal I
what
am.
Else? What else is there?
Yeah. Yeah. And this poem I chose in particular because the street that I grew up on in Washington, D.C., not on my block, but on the very next block, was lined with ginkgo trees, which are beautiful trees, and in autumn, their leaves are golden fans. I mean, they have a downside. The female trees drop their fruit, which we lovingly called stink bombs.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, their beauty sort of outweighed that. And so I chose this poem.
Yeah.
The Consent. Late in November, on a single night, not even near to freezing, the ginkgo trees that line the pathway let go all their leaves in one consent, and neither to rain nor to wind, but as though to time alone, the golden and green leaves litter the lawn today that yesterday still spread aloft their fluttering fans of light. What signal from the stars? What senses took it in? What in those wooden motives so decided to strike their leaves, to down their leaves, rebellion or surrender? And if this can happen thus, what race shall be exempt? What use to learn the lessons taught by time if a star at any time may tell us now? Wow.
That's beautiful.
Oh, wow.
Those of you who know me
yeah.
know why this
that is beautiful.
Yeah. Hits
well
me.
Well done.
Absolutely beautiful. Okay, I think we're good to end on that one.
On an upbeat note.
Really? No, that was
no, it's
perfect.
Absolutely beautiful. And it, but it does speak to, as Michael's saying, it speaks to the power of words.
It does. Mm-hmm.
Words
no, it really
written
does.
Yes,
in a certain moves. Way really can evoke powerful emotions, which is incredible.
And just for our bartenders outside, if we could get a refill here from Mr.
I definitely need one.
I'll be getting one.
Yes, absolutely.
Howard Nemirov, thank you.
That was brilliant.
We
thank
are.
You, Jeannie.
Thank you, Jeannie. Yeah. So we are going to take a break, correct,
yes.
Mark? We're
going
to take a break, and
excellent
then we'll come back with Alan. Hotshot lawyer by day, international intrigue writer by night.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books. I'm still trying to find a handkerchief to dry my eyes.
Sorry.
Oh, no.
Jeannie's,
that was beautiful.
Jeannie's emotional reading, and also Michael's reading of Shakespeare. Everybody, Langston Hughes.
I know.
Even you, Tori, with Little Willie.
Just, this show has a way of reinforcing things, and it just reinforces I am the most superficial person at the table.
Stop
the danger
it.
Of
yes.
going first.
Stop. Exactly. No, I knew which way the arc of that segment was going to go. I thought it was important to go first and get that out of the way. So we are back for our featured author segment, which is indeed sponsored by Calvert Woodley, wonderful Calvert Woodley, over at 4339 Connecticut Avenue. You go there and you say Chatter 5 at checkout, you get $5 off. Ooh. Even though we didn't have a wine and cheese this evening because Michael, God bless him, is at the French Embassy doing something
He's
important.
Very, yes.
So he blew us off, but we'll still give
it's
him
okay.
the we'll still yeah. give him the read. Yeah. But we're here with Alan Topol, who, as I said, is a hotshot lawyer by day for many years, and has written 14 of these books, all geopolitical thrillers, as they're called. But Alan, thank you so much for being here. And I was reading lots of different things, and I found that fun article in the Washingtonian about a lot of lawyers in Washington who write fiction. And I'm always fascinated when you think about Washington. People in Washington all want to be jocks. They all want to be the athlete. They want to know the big athletes. People in Hollywood want to be politicians. Lawyers want to write fiction. Why do lawyers want to write fiction? Is the day job so bad, Alan?
Well, actually, that's funny you say it that way, because once I was giving a book talk to a luncheon out in California, and somebody asked that question. It was an afternoon luncheon. Audience was hall was full. People right after brunch, and then they're having questions. And somebody asks exactly your question. And before I had a chance to answer, somebody else stands up and yells, "Boredom!" But there may be something to that. Is hey, we find law exciting, but we'd like something else for a lot of us. And we're used to writing, and we're used to thinking. And so it's not such a far cry to want to write something creative. Now, my wife says, Barbara, who's here, she says, well, your some of your fiction is like the things you write in your briefs. And I said, no, positively not. I mean, there's my fiction, and then there's my legal writing. Mm-hmm. But I think we're used to writing all the time, and so I think that's what works. The other thing where law is a very useful for writing is in the law business, you meet a lot of interesting people, a lot of interesting characters, clients, people on the other side, lawyers on the other side, judges, witnesses, individuals.
Right.
And it's those individuals that give rise to the ability to frame a story. And then for me, there's a third ingredient. I was always interested in writing nonfiction. And I did a number of op-ed pieces for newspapers. I had pieces in the Post and the New York Times and some other periodicals. But I realized that with writing nonfiction, too hard to get them published. They're here one day and gone the next.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my inspiration, actually, on a very cold morning in 1973, mm-hmm. when I was waiting in a gas line on MacArthur Boulevard.
Oh, boy, those were years.
Yes, that'll take you back.
Yes.
Gas rash.
You were waiting
US.
A while.
I was waiting a while.
Don't make me go through that again. Yeah.
Hey, I was angry, and there I was, and I was going to write a nonfiction piece, and I said, hey, don't do that. Turn it into a novel, and I turned it into a novel.
There you go.
So,
wow.
Anyhow, that was
okay, 5 years old, what did you want to be? Did you ever think you were going to grow up and be writing these fabulous books?
No, I didn't. I really didn't. But by the time I got to college, and I was studying chemistry at, it was Carnegie Tech in those days, Carnegie Mellon
yes.
now.
Yes, mm-hmm. God bless you.
By the time I got there, then I was beginning to get a bug. And Carnegie Tech did not have a fiction writing department then. Now it's one of the most important undergraduate fiction writing schools in the country.
Oh my gosh.
But it didn't even have an apartment then. And I twisted the arm of one of my English professors who had experience teaching fiction. And I said, will you give me a tutorial? And I was kind of off and running. And I really had the bug. And it's something I wanted to do. I wanted to tell stories. And I really enjoyed doing it.
You did. So you draw from your real life experiences as a lawyer and the characters and the stories. Have you ever become so close in your books that somebody recognized themselves?
Well, I try to. Well, the standard answer is, my answer is, the individuals that in the books are composites of people that I've met along the way.
Oh, yes. Like the little thing at the start of Law and Order.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It's ripped from the headlines. We need to talk real people.
But some of them end up being, you know, a little more similar than you would like to do. Like, I'm working on a book now, which is my newest book. It's going to be my 15th, called The Washington Operator. And that book is being built around a powerful Washington lobbyist. Hey, now, I started to write the book, and then along comes all this Manafort stuff and Podesta stuff, and suddenly, and
it's hard to beat real life.
It's hard to beat, but I'm trying to beat real life. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to come up with somebody who's even more greedy and more venal than some of the people we've been reading about.
Any ostrich jacket in there?
Yeah, but hey, this isn't easy.
Right.
I mean, a book, you know, it's funny when you said about writing what you do. So for my first, I don't know, 12 or so books or 10, I never really zeroed in so much on lawyers and Washington lawyers. Mm-hmm. And then I said, wait a minute, it's what I know. I was writing more international. I wanted to educate people about an international topic at the same time that I was entertaining them, hopefully. And for example, China's effort to make inroads into the United States, Russia's resurgence. But then I thought, why not try a Washington book? So I wrote a book called The Washington Lawyer, which I'm proud of because it got a very, very nice review in the Washington Post. It came out about 3 years ago. It was reviewed by Pat Anderson on his Monday Thriller column. But in that, I have a very powerful Washington lawyer in a big law firm, and people have said, well, is that any relationship to your law firm? And I said, no, just the fact that it has oriental carpets and wooden floors doesn't bear any relationship to my law firm. But so I built it around a powerful Washington lawyer, and he has a chance to go on the U.S. Supreme Court. He's on the short list. And something happens. A friend of his, who's a senator, very close friend, he lent his Caribbean house to the senator for a weekend.
Again, this happens every week,
right,
doesn't it?
Yes, yes, doesn't it? Exactly. Of course. And he thought the senator was going down with his wife.
Colleen Ted Kennedy.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. There you go. And the senator went with a young woman and something, a staffer, and something happened to the staffer.
Yeah.
Something bad happened. And hey, but the question is, what's this going to do to our Washington lawyer and his chances to be Supreme Court justice? What's it going to do to his chances? And that became the focus.
Did he drink
that
beer? Point. Did he drink beer?
Well,
like
they
beer.
Drank a lot of things, right?
I like beer. I like beer.
Lots of beer.
Right. They like a lot of things. Yeah. So anyhow, but so then I did a Washington, and then people said, well, I mean, is that your law firm or these, you know, lawyers you've worked with, lawyers you know about? But as you all said, the situation is a very Washington situation. Mm-hmm. And it really gave rise. I started thinking about, this is a kind of an interesting question, and I wonder you all have thought about it, is it turns out that there are a lot of people who are scoundrels in Washington. Okay, let's say for lack of a better
word. Okay, let's just stop there. No one's ever heard that before
okay,
in this town.
But, never. But yeah. Here's the question. Now, here's the question. Are people like that attracted to Washington, and that's why we seem to have more? Or is there something in the Potomac air that when they get here, they're otherwise nice, upstanding people, and then they get into a change of character?
That is an excellent question, right? Why do robbers go to banks? Because that's where the money is.
Right.
You could go down lots of paths of why people find themselves in certain places, because they know they can do what they want to do there. I think that's an excellent question. My dear friend John McCain, God rest his soul, would say that the town corrupts. He thinks that people would come to town. He used to embrace brand new members of Congress, guys, gals, everybody, and he'd run around and introduce them to reporters and say, get to know them before this town ruins them.
Well, and
so his theory was the town ruins
as
them.
As a native Washingtonian, I would take the other position on that, that this town is this town. It's politics is part of it, mm-hmm. but there are plenty of pure, interesting people here who are not corrupt, and it's not Potomac fever, that a certain kind of person comes here and he's already well formed in that personality.
Yeah, I was just thinking of the sequel to Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Mr. Smith takes kickbacks, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
No, but you know, if you think
yes.
about
it,
indicted.
I'm innocent.
But you know, if you think about it, for all of us who have lived here a long time, I mean, we've seen some things that are so bizarre. Talk about Fannie Fox,
sure.
and
yes.
Wilbur Mills.
Wilbur sure. Mills.
I mean, a stripper.
Tidal Basin. Yeah.
She's
yeah.
in.
Yeah.
She's in a limousine with the head of the House Ways and Means Committee.
It
takes
seems kind
of
cute
her coat,
now.
Stark naked and yes. jumps into the Tidal Basin. I
yeah,
mean,
that seems like an anecdote, like
yeah.
a charming anecdote now.
Right.
To what's going
You guys remember John Tower?
Yes.
Sure.
Right?
Yes.
The failed nomination to be Secretary of Defense?
Yes.
And John McCain, God rest his soul, had decided that even though the White House had abandoned that nomination because it was in trouble because of things like he had girls and he said
Sally Quinn
inappropriate
has written
things.
About yeah.
And, but John McCain decided, no, he's a friend of mine. We're going to do everything we can possibly do. And so in addition to everything else the young senator from Arizona was doing, we were full tilt on trying to support the failed nomination, even though we knew it was failed mm-hmm. and even though we knew it was not going to help John's career. But anyhow, every day there were new rumors, new allegations, new craziness. And John McCain would be out in Arizona a lot, and he would call me first thing in the morning. It was usually 8 o'clock my time, 5:30, 6 o'clock his time, and say, okay, what's the latest? And I'd read him the latest accusation, and he'd go, oh, crazy, stupid. So he calls me one morning. He says, what's the latest? I said, oh, my God. I said, you won't believe this. Now they're saying, back when he was on the Armed Services Committee, he would sit there, and he would put his vodka glass on his head when it was empty. And that was the sign for the girls, as it was they were called then, to refill his vodka glass. Mm-hmm. And I said it with just total exasperation in my voice. And John McCain goes, oh, yeah, I remember that. But now, well, in today's standards, it looks adorable.
Yeah, but hey, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I know. What was your neighborhood? Which neighborhood?
East End. I went to Peabody High School.
Okay, there you go. My dad grew up in Dormont.
Okay,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, went to Mount Lebanon High School.
Right.
It's a great town.
It is a great town.
It's a fabulous town.
And I've put a lot of my characters. I mean, for example, I have the Craig Page book and Craig Page series of books. And I put those characters in Western Pennsylvania because I love those areas, those steel mill towns.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
There you go. You grew
yeah.
up in one, so you're
yeah.
you're familiar with it. I mean, those are sort of towns that had some kind of individual ethnic character. But you come back to my question. So I don't think things like this go on in Pittsburgh that go on here. I mean, really.
Different levels of corruption.
Well, that's true.
Alan, have you found the last couple of years incredible fertile ground for future novels? Or is it challenging?
Right. I was going to pick up on what Tori said. I mean, the answer is I was once going to, and I figured, nah, it's a waste of time. I was going to write an op-ed piece that said, pity the poor Washington lawyer, because it's so hard for us to imagine plots that are going to hold people's interest when all the stuff that's going on in the real world.
Right.
So on the one hand, yes, it's, as you point out, it is fertile material. But on the other hand, I mean, you know, you can't get the readers want to be yawning and saying, right.
We've seen this.
Which is why I've taken a lot of my stuff internationally, because I think the international stuff is kind of fun. It's something I'm interested in, and so I like to write about.
And your international stuff, Russia, China, all over Europe, Syria. You and Barbara been to most of these places?
Yes, we have. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
The newest book has, a lot of it takes place in Budapest, and we took two trips there and try to weave in what happened in the 1956 rebellion. Italy we love, and I did a book, The Italian Divide, and I tried to focus on not only the messed up Italian politics, but the conflict between the North and the South, which is why it's called The Italian Divide. And that's a real kind of a rivalry, almost enmity, so that in some families you either marry a Northerner or you marry a Southerner. And I like delving into those international issues, because those are things that sometimes a lot of people won't know about. And I also get up on kind of it's hard, you don't want to be on a soapbox. You can't lecture if you're going to write novels. Mm. On the other hand, I feel strongly about some things that I've written about. For example, China's incursions into the United States and their challenges to the U.S. for world domination. So I've been writing about that for a number of years in my fiction, because I find it an intriguing
topic. People are finally catching on.
Yeah, and I want to do a kind of a wake-up call.
Favorite child of all your books? Do you have a favorite child?
That's a hard one.
Barbara, do you have a favorite one?
My answer is, do you have multiple children?
Yeah. Trust me, I have three, and depending on the day, yes, sometimes I've got a favorite.
Yeah, I mean, if you forced me to it and you made me pick, it might be about my sixth or so book, a book called Spy Dance. I really got attached to that. It was a former CIA agent who was on the run, and because he had been in Saudi Arabia, he'd been the station chief, and the U.S. government was doing some stupid things with the Saudi, and he broke the jaw of a general in charge of a powerful American base. So that put him on the run. And then some people who want to make an effort to take over the Saudi oil fields try to find him, though he's been undercover. He's been living in Israel. He's made a new life for himself. And they find him, and they want to involve him in their effort to take over Saudi oil fields. And in some ways, that book all kind of came together. So it's the one that pops up for me now.
Nice. But do you know the endings when you write your books? When you sit down to write a book, do you know the ending?
Well, what I do is, the answer is pretty much yes and no. What I do is I start with writers go two ways, fiction writers. There are some who say, well, I just sit down and I write, and wherever it leads me, it leads me. I can't work like that. I start with a detailed outline, maybe, I don't know, 30 or 40, 50 pages, and then I'll start writing through the outline, but not paying strict attention to it. And you can't strict literally, and then it'd be like to the dots. You have to be willing to change, create new characters, and so forth and so forth. But as I go, I'm changing the plot. And sometimes I'm changing the ending too, as to where it goes. So Some writers, I love this expression because it's so, it doesn't make any sense. The characters talk to me. No characters ever talk to me.
Oh, you see that all the time.
Yeah, you love that. Writers love to say, the characters talk to me. They tell me which way the story should go. That's nonsense.
I think those writers probably do a lot of drugs.
And did you start off as a lawyer writing on legal pads and then move into computers? Or what is your actual process now? And you're so prolific. I mean, what helps that?
I'm embarrassed to tell you, I am still writing on legal pads. Although there's a difference is times have changed. They're not yellow anymore.
Right?
You can't have yellow paper. And they're not 8.5 by 14 because we don't have it. So it's 8.5 by 11.
That's interesting.
Pads, but, and obviously I have computers, I have iPads. I don't want to make out I'm a Luddite, but I just think better when I have a pencil in my hand and it's just, and it also makes it a hell of a lot easier to do revisions and pull the little squiggles here and the squiggles there. But I know I'm a bit of a dinosaur.
Cutting
nobody
and pasting
else
is much
way.
Easier on a computer, though, doesn't it? When you want to sort of move a block around, isn't
yeah,
it? Kind
I guess
of,
so.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's just, anyhow.
Alan Greenspan still sits, evidently, I've heard from a good source, sits in a bathtub every morning with a yellow legal pad or whatever it is now and writes out his thoughts
now,
by hand.
I do have one advantage, I must say, and that a number of years ago, Stephen King wrote a book on writing, and in it, he talks about the writing process. And I'm not a big Stephen King fan. I mean, personally, I've tried a number of his books, and I can never get very deeply into it. But his book on writing was very, very helpful and constructive. But one of the things that he said was that every writer, if you can, you need to have a first reader. That's important on the writing process. You need somebody who will read your first drafts and look at them and give you constructive comments. They're not having an ego trip, but they read enough. And I'm fortunate that my wife, Barbara, is my first reader. She's in-house. She reads an enormous amount, and she offers constructive suggestions. But that's an important part of the writing process because I will, when I start... Another thing I picked up, you were asking about writing habits, was which I got once I was using Al Zuckerman, the agent. And what Al said, his suggestion, which I love and I adapt, is I'll write a first draft in the white heat, he used to call it, is don't edit, don't go chapter by chapter. Mm-hmm. Start and go straight through with that first draft. And only when you have that first draft entirely done, then go back and look at page one and start
that's
to
great
edit
advice.
And revise.
That
I
is
love
great
that advice.
Yeah.
In journalism, we call that raw copy. It really was raw.
That's
I love that, really. That's great.
So the latest, Russian Resurgence, which is real life, God bless you for writing about real life, what's next?
Well,
there's not part of the world you haven't touched.
Okay, what's next is the Washington Operator, which, as I say, involves my lobbyist that I've created, George Corbin, my greedy and venal lobbyist. But the part of the world we're dealing with in this novel is Iran and Saudi Arabia, because I can't get away from the Middle East. I mean, I get away from it on whole books, but I keep getting dragged back because what's going on is so critical and so really important. And so I ended up, and that's where I'm headed next, that my Washington lobbyist, George Corbin, and the Washington Operator gets drawn into a plot hatched by China to utilize Iran as its puppet to take over much of Middle Eastern oil.
Yeah.
And Corbin is brought into that plot.
Right. They might be switching you from fiction to nonfiction. You might just have a different place on the shelves. Will Calvert Woodley be in your next book in Washington Operator?
Yes, actually, I'm glad you asked.
Michael Sands is very proud of the fact that Calvert Woodley gets featured in your books.
Oh, they do. I'll tell you, it's a funny story how that happened. I've known Ed Sands for a long time. I love Ed. He's a terrific guy, and it's a wonderful wine store, too. But so what happened was I was writing a book, Enemy of My Enemy. And the protagonist was a Mossad agent in Paris whose cover was he was a wine He was a wine dealer, and so he would get wine from the French vineyards and chateaus, and he would ship them around the world. That's what my protagonist did.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to create a scene that showed his character at the beginning. It wasn't so dependent on the plot. And so what I recalled is an incident several years earlier. Wine from, I think it was the 2000 Lectures came out, and I and some other people had bought some of those wines on auction. And it was I bought a relatively small number. I mean, this is really a big deal. But what happened is the wine was not available because Ed had contracted for it, but the supplier, since the price went up, the supplier said, no, we won't give you the wine. Too bad. But Ed stuck with the deals that he made with his customers, a very, very honorable way of doing business.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to put a scene like that in the book. I did the draft. I ran the draft by him. He gave me comments. I said, Ed, do you want me to put you in the book? Or you want me just to thank you? Or what do you want to do? He said, will you put me in the book? I said, sure.
I love it.
And so he said, fine, then we'll do a wine tasting when your book came out and have a book signing. And we've done that for all
my
books.
That's
great. You're there on May 5th, right?
No, I don't have a date for that.
Oh, I thought you have a date coming up.
No.
Okay. Well, it is great to have you here. I'm in awe of just your abilities to predict things that are now happening in real life. God help us. Mm-hmm. But the latest is Russian Resurgence. The next one is Washington Operator. That's going to be the title.
Exactly. Coming out this summer.
Everyone should go and get that.
Absolutely. Yep.
Can you stay with us? We've got to take a quick break here, and then we're going to come back with this evening, Castaway Island.
Yes.
Sure.
Books that you want to give up on.
Sure.
Okay,
it's
stay with us.
Like.
Thank you, Alan Topol.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy. Yes.
We are back. We are back. Chatter on Books at Chatter on the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer Streets, Northwest. And instead of Deserted Island this time, which we'll return to, it's a very popular segment.
At some point.
But instead of Deserted Island, we're going to do Castaway Island, which is when is it okay to give up on a book? When is it okay to quit? I can't quit you. When is it okay to Marie Kondo a book? Michael, would you like to go first?
I wish I could take this book back and use the Arch Campbell line. Didn't see it, don't want to see it. This was actually a book I mentioned on one of your earlier shows, and it was called Boomer One. I was really interested in this.
Oh, yeah.
It came out as a hardcover. It's one of those books where I think I had to shut it and put it away because I could see through the conceit too easily, looking at a millennial who has no real professional goals in mind, wants to be a writer, but doesn't actually have a plan as to how to get into this field, ends up moving back in with his parents. You start to see an exploration of the mother's young years out west, and that's as far as I got.
And good for
this
you.
Is
okay.
I felt so happy to put it down, but it was so hard because it was a hardcover, and there's something about that hardcover that stares at you from
the
shelf.
There's a commitment with a hardcover.
And you like to look through your library and say, even if I didn't get, say, the most enjoyment out of it, I still find value in finishing a book. And this one, I just said, enough's enough.
Your
it's been easier.
Valuable.
Yeah, there was one other book, a fantasy book, that I was reading on my iPad, and that didn't even make it through two pages, no looking back. Not going to name names.
Time is too valuable.
Hmm?
Mark or Jeannie, you want to go? Jeannie will go.
Yeah, sure,
she's
go.
Ready.
Well, I'll say this, that I have changed dramatically in my feelings about when to cast away a book.
Now you think it's okay.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I used to hang in there. Lately, okay, maybe halfway. No, I don't care how this ends. I'm bailing. But I saw, I went to this interview with Kate Atkinson, who's a British novelist, writes some detective novels, but also some wonderful novels. Life After Life is one of my favorite ones. And the interviewer asked her when she gives up on a book. Three paragraphs. I knew after three paragraphs that I don't want to read it. And I was like, okay, Kate, I'm with you.
Kate gave you permission.
She gave me permission. I'll hang in there a little bit longer, but sometimes after the first chapter, and because I read now on an iPad, I don't have the sort of guilty thing of this hardback book sitting there staring at
you.
Me. So I just like delete, start again, another $14.99 down the drain.
Yeah. Okay.
That's funny.
David?
Oh, there's so many. I tried very hard to read the David Marinus book about Obama. I really did, because it was like, I'm going to go to Hawaii. I'm going to talk to his family. I'm going to go back seven generations. I'm going to go look and find it all out. And I got about 70 pages in. I was like, is this going to pick up at any point? Because we're still in 1831. Can we get going here?
That's interesting, because David Marinus has written some great stuff.
Yes, I thought
it's interesting.
I'm sure it's a great book.
But
sure it is. But
he is very careful, and you've got to believe Obama was very careful, which generally does not make for good reading.
Yeah, it's still on my Kindle. I still mean to pick it up at some point.
Let it go. Let it go.
Yeah, let it go.
Mark?
Yeah, I think I'm with Jeannie on this, and actually with all you guys. I used to resist it. I said, no, I've started this, and you finish what you start.
Right.
And then you're reading something, you're like, this is just garbage. What am I doing?
I'm wasting it.
And then I had a long talk with my mom about this, and we came to the same. Life is too short to read crappy books. And if you're in the middle of something and you don't like it, if you want to know how it ends, just skip ahead, read the last paragraph. Like, okay, I got closure. But don't waste your time with that. And I would recite all the books that I have bailed on, but I don't remember them. Because if it's like literally like a chapter in, you're like, eh. No, enough with you.
Well, as you guys know, I spent too many years of my life trying to get through Moby Dick, which I finally did to realize it was 850 pages of knots, of tying knots, which is a total waste of my time. I used to try, too, and I wonder if is it age or just the lives we lead now where life is too short. But I had, in at least three or four places I have lived and on nightstand tables, Love in the Time of Cholera, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, for years. And I knew it was an important book, and I knew he was an important person. And yes, you should read this. And I just would kind of move it and turn it over, and it haunted me for years. And then I decided for this segment, okay, I'm going to pick it up again. I'm just going to give you the highlights from this book. Some romance, you know, but there's a lot of tragedy in it. Unrequited love, unrequited love, unrequited love. Tragic death related to a parrot. I kid you not. Tragic death related to a parrot.
I read it a long time ago.
Yeah. And I really think its fame came largely from critics who have these sad lives. Most critics have sad lives, who appreciated the fact that it was about this tragedy and unrequited love. So I read about 10 pages of it and said, okay, that's it. Gone. It's been Marie Kondo'd, which I think we all should embrace. There's so many wonderful things to write out there. I mean, to read out there, including all these wonderful books by Alan Topel. Yes. Do you have a book you've given up on? Have you ever quit a book? Do you have any time to read books?
No, but see, what I do is I do a lot of my reading is research for background.
Right.
I mean, history stuff.
Sure.
For example, there was an excellent book about the Shah of Iran, and that I went through that, and I studied that every word because I was interested in the subject. And if it's a research book, and it's not, I'm not finding it enormously interesting, then I'll skip around to portions that are what I'm interested in. But when I can, on airplanes and stuff, I also try to read some fiction, spy, international intrigue stuff.
Who are your heroes?
And that's where, well, I go back to the old stuff. If you ask my heroes, Graham Greene's my hero.
Sure, yeah.
Graham, but your comment is such a good one. Kindle makes it easier to stop a book. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I'm reading some contemporary spy novels, I mean, the Matthews books, for example, I mean, one was made into a movie. The first one, was okay. But, you know, after that, wait a minute, life's too short. But Kindle makes it easy to stop. You don't feel guilty.
That's
You're not
right.
looking at the book. you know, I blew whatever, 10 or I didn't blow $30
right.
on it. But still, it makes it easier to
see.
Life's
yeah.
too short.
That's
I'm not
right.
going to do
I'm
this.
I'm with you.
Well, everyone should read your books. Alan Topel should read Russian
Thank
Resurgence,
you,
should be
Tori.
Ready for the Amen. Next one, come back when the next one is out. We would love to have you with us. Mark, we're finished up?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
What's coming up next week?
What's coming up next week is another hometown heroine, Julie Langsdorff, who has written a book called The White Elephant.
Okay.
Which, remember back, we were talking about the dreaded New York Times, here are 12 books you must read in March, which is just a dreadful list, but we all kind of looked at The White Elephant, which is about some neighborhood in the Washington, D.C. area, and it's about McMansions and trees coming down and egos. And I have read it, and I have listened to it, and it is fabulous, and I didn't want it to end.
Oh,
so we have her
wonderful.
Next week. So thank you to Zach and the gang here at Chatter, and we will see you next week, episode 21.
Yay! Yay.